is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, Hoopheads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish Home Machine, which is perfect for these crazy times when gyms and schools are closed. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Coach Mark Anderson from the Owensboro Thoroughbreds of the TBL, and you're listening to the Hoopheads Podcast.
Hey, Hoopheads, we all hate ankle sprains, and they happen way too often. Ankle injuries are the number one sports-related injury. Arise is trying to change that. With the iFast, your athletes get preventative protection and full mobility. Athletes no longer need to wear bulky braces that limit performance and give mediocre protection. Anyone playing sports should be using these products. Keep your athletes in the game. Don't wait for them to get hurt to take action. Visit www.arise.com, spelled A-R-Y-S-E, and use the code HOOPHEADS to get 20% off the future of performance. That's A-R-Y-S-E.com with promo code HOOPHEADS to get 20% off.
Let's leave a legacy that you can one day bring your kids and your family back and say, I was a part of something special.
Cabrel Huff is the head boys basketball coach at Holy Innocents Episcopal School in Atlanta, Georgia. During the 2019-2020 season, Huff took the team to the Elite Eight. Prior to coaching at Holy Innocents, Huff had been a successful head coach at Duluth High School. In Huff's three seasons at Duluth High, he took the team to three consecutive state tournament appearances, including back-to-back Sweet 16s. His overall record at Duluth was 54-36. Prior to arriving at Duluth, Huff spent two seasons coaching college basketball. At Alcorn State University in 2015-2016, he assisted in leading the Braves to a total program turnaround, resulting in second place in the conference. While at Georgia Southern University in 2014-2015, he helped guide the Eagles to a 22-9 record. Prior to his time at the college level, Coach Huff was a successful coach at St. Francis High School in Alpharetta, Georgia for six seasons. Cabrel has also coached at Cedartown High and Atlanta International High, as well as professionally in the WBA and the ABA. Coach Huff currently has two players playing in the NBA, Malik Beasley of the Minnesota Timberwolves and Kobe Simmons, currently a two-way player for the Charlotte Hornets. Don't miss our free Hoopheads Pod webinar series on Thursday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern. If you miss a live webinar, you can buy lifetime access to any of our previous webinars for $4.99 on the Hoopheads Pod website. If you're focused on improving your coaching and your team, we've got you covered. Visit hoopheadspod.com/webinars to get registered. Make sure you check out our new Hoopheads Pod network of shows, including Thrive with Trevor Huffman, Beyond the Ball, the CoachMaze.com podcast, Players Court, Bleachers and Boards, and our team-focused NBA podcasts, Cavalier Central, Grizz and Grind, Knuck a Few Buck, The 305 Culture, and Blazing the Path. We're looking for more NBA podcasters interested in hosting their own show centered on a particular team. Shoot an email to info@hoopheadspod.com if you're interested in learning more and bringing your talent to our network. Get a pen and paper ready now so you can take some notes as you listen to this episode with Cabrel Huff from Holy Innocents Episcopal School in Atlanta, Georgia.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast from Holy Innocents Episcopal School in Atlanta, Georgia, head boys basketball coach Cabrel Huff. Cabrel, welcome to the Hoopheads Pod.
It's a privilege. Glad to be on. Have listened to you guys a lot and have gained some knowledge, so hopefully I can do the same in our brief conversation tonight.
Well, I can honestly say that we've had many guests that have come on and say that they've listened to a lot of episodes, but with you, there is definitive proof out there on the internet of you retweeting and sharing out some of the things that our great guests have said in the past. So I want to just start off by saying thank you for that. And I know there's a lot of things that you've passed along from our podcast that have gone out on your Twitter feed to coaches. And again, that's really what this whole thing is about, is trying to grow the game of basketball and improve the coaching profession. So we thank you for that and really looking forward to diving in with you tonight. So let's start out by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell us a little bit about how you got in the game of basketball when you were younger.
I guess I was blessed to have some length and some being tall, which kind of ran in my family, but didn't. My parents weren't tall, but my grandparents were, and some people, some brothers and sisters on my mom or dad's side were. And so it was kind of the sport I kind of grew to love more so than even baseball or football, which I played growing up as well. And really it was, anybody that knows me knows my love for anything Atlanta, having grown up in Atlanta, Georgia, and kind of been here most of my life. And so it was my fondness of this guy we call the human highlight film, Dominique Wilkins. Everybody else probably thought Michael Jordan was their favorite player, but Dominique Wilkins was my favorite player. So that was kind of what got me going, and I would go in my backyard and try to practice his spin move into the finger roll. Couldn't quite windmill dunk like he could, but I tried everything else, you know, him hitting bank shots and all that kind of stuff. And so that's kind of what got me into basketball right there, was watching the Hawks growing up in the 80s.
How old were you when the Bird Dominique duel took place?
Oh, what was that, 1988?
I think it was 88, yep.
I am 9 years old.
Okay.
Don't get me started about why Cliff Levinson took the shot in game 6 and Dominique didn't take that shot. You know, there are two times in our history that I thought we had a chance. And I'm not even including the time we get to the conference finals, which is the only time the Atlanta Hawks get to the conference finals. But that was 1 year. And unfortunately, the year we traded Dominique, I thought if we had kept him, that was another year we could have really done some damage in the playoffs.
Well, welcome to being a tortured fan base. Other than the time, I guess we've kind of gotten spoiled here in Cleveland, getting a chance to watch LeBron over the years. But certainly prior to that, and in any other sport, as I'm sure Coach Jason can attest to.
We're Browns fans. That's all I have to say. We are Browns. Although
if Cabrera is a Falcons fan, it's not going well for him this year.
No, it's not. Let's stay with basketball right now. I don't want to get to football. I might cut this podcast short.
All right, continue. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead. Keep rolling on your Atlanta sports fandom.
But that was it. And then add into the fact that, you know, I then grew to love college basketball, and Lethal Weapon 3 was just something that was really big. The 1990 team that went to the Final Four, Kenny Anderson, Dennis Scott, Brian Oliver, those were some great teams. That was a great team, and they had some great players. And watching Bobby Crimmins coach that team, I think those are the two things that really led me to basketball and grew my love for it and playing it, you know, obviously in high school and getting opportunity a little bit in college. And then, you know, just the evolution of basketball and allowing a kid to grow in the game was kind of what started me in coaching. You know, I grew to love teaching. It wasn't something that I started out in college to do. I wanted to be a journalist, ironically, since we're on this podcast. But God sometimes has different things in store for you. And teaching was one of those things. And that led me to coaching.
So how'd you end up, talk a little bit about your high school playing career and then kind of how you ended up at Morehouse and what your experiences were like as a high school player and then in the opportunity that you got to play in college?
The head coach at Mays High School was definitely a hard nose, got to find a do it the right way, do the things his way kind of coach. And it was really good playing for him. You learned how to play the game the right way. You learn how to do the necessary things to do your job and only your job. But unfortunately, between my junior and senior year, I got hurt in a game where a dude undercut me. I was going up to try to dunk and a dude undercut me and I fell on my hip. And, you know, just thinking it was just, you know, something minor, you know, maybe a hip pointer. I actually tried to go back in the game and got a rebound, but couldn't run the floor after I made the outlet pass. Realized something was wrong, but after a couple of days, it was over. I was ready. I could go back and play basketball again, but my mom's friend was a nurse, and she said, just go get him checked out. Go get Cabrera checked out to make sure he's all right. And unbeknownst to us, I had a benign tumor on my hip that had been there my whole life.
Wow.
And if that hadn't happened at that point, probably by the age of 25, I would have had the Bo Jackson reconstructive hip surgery. Wow. So it definitely changed my life. It made me see things differently. It made me view things differently. I tell people it was probably the thing that humbled me very early in my life, because everything I did centered around basketball, charts playing. I had decent grades, you know, pretty good grades, because my parents wouldn't let me play unless I did had those grades. But it all centered around basketball. I was getting those grades because it was like, well, if I don't get these grades, I'm not going to be able to play.
Right.
But after that, it really changed. And my pastor, Dr. Aaron L. Parker, was a professor at Morehouse, and his son and I grew up being great friends. Even though we went to rival schools, he went to Westlake, I went to Mays High School here in Atlanta. And he was the influence that said, you need to go to Morehouse and start your journey there and see where it leads you. So that's how I kind of ended up at Morehouse College. And in all honesty, it's probably the best thing that ever happened to me.
What was so positive about the experience for you there?
Lifelong friends, the ability to learn how to lead. I think that's one of the great things that Morehouse teaches you. You see it in the alumni base that we have, but it teaches you how to lead. It teaches you how to be a leader amongst men, just by the conversations, not even just the classes, but the conversations. And it broadens your horizons. You know, it's still a liberal arts school, so you got to take religion, you've got to take music, you got to take art. And obviously being in the Mecca, you know, as an African-American male, being in Atlanta, that was during that time. That was the time when, you know, hip hop was really beginning to big in the South, with Outkast and some groups of that nature. So it was just a great time to learn, a great time to explore. And it led me to some people, to some lifelong friends, not just friends, but mentors, you know, guys who graduated, men who graduated from Morehouse before myself. And it also turns you on to being leaders to guys who came after you. Part of the, you know, one of the biggest things I've had in my career is having a player. You know, he didn't go to play basketball at Morehouse, but he went to Morehouse to run track. And that's probably one of the things I smile about to this day.
Yeah, that's really cool when you get an opportunity to have somebody kind of follow in your footsteps as a coach and sort of walk in those same shoes that you walked in at one point. And I know, just speaking for myself here, I am back. I haven't always lived in the town that I grew up in, but I've been back now for probably 11 or 12 years. And so my kids are going through the same high school that I went to. And so it's kind of neat just to see them kind of in the same environment that you grew up in. And I'm sure it's a similar feeling with players that end up going and kind of having, again, a similar experience, especially because your experience, as it sounds like, was so positive and you felt like you drew so many lessons and things that have influence you well beyond your years that you spent at Morehouse to have a positive impact on your life. And so you mentioned earlier about going into the your college experience thinking that you were going to be a journalist, and then at some point you started switching over and thinking about teaching and coaching. So how did that shift take place? Was there one specific moment that stood out? Was it kind of a gradual, just from what you were exposed to while you're at Morehouse? Talk a little bit about that transition in terms of what you saw your life path being.
So I'm probably one of those kids that listened to sports talk radio from like the age of 12 until even now. And so I watched all sports, baseball, football, basketball. And I began to notice, you know, unfortunately at that time, many African-American males were not in the journalism business unless they had played at the professional level. So, not saying I couldn't get it done, but I said, I need to find a plan B. And plan B said I was majoring in English because Morehouse didn't have journalism. So I said, well, let me begin to take some education classes at our sister college, Spelman, which is, you know, in the Atlanta University Center. Everything's right there. And so once I began to take those classes, it kind of really changed me. It drew me away from journalism to realizing that helping kids, you know, reach their goals was definitely more important than me being a journalist, to be honest with you.
So when you make that switch, are you thinking then at that point that teaching and coaching are going to be a part of your future? Did those two kind of go hand in hand, or were you still just more focused maybe on the teaching piece of it, and the coaching came a little bit later. Just how did that come to be?
So it's really funny that you asked that question, because one of my good friends growing up, he told me this probably about a year ago. He said, I remember when you told us when you were still in high school that you were going to be a coach one day. And nobody, like everybody kind of looked at you like, oh, okay, that's what you want to do. But even at that time, although it was in my mind, it wasn't like, okay, I'm doing this so I can coach. But then right around the time when I decided and realized that my playing career was done. Like the injury had taken its toll. I wasn't the same player anymore. When I stopped playing, I realized that let me try to help somebody else reach their goal, and not even through teaching. So I began actually coaching my church league team, which was, you know, Zion Hill Baptist Church. And these kids, these young men, were like 2 years, at most 2-3 years younger than me. And we were very successful, and that kind of got the itch going right there. But I had no idea that going into my first year teaching right after graduation, that somebody was going to give me the keys to a JV basketball program.
So did you feel, when that opportunity came to be, did you feel prepared for that because of your previous experience with the church league team, or did you feel woefully unprepared once you stood in front of a JV team?
I thought I was prepared as far as telling them what to do, but you're never prepared for that step up until you actually get into it. And I don't care what level you're talking about. If it's going from, you know, rec league to JV, JV to varsity, varsity to college, college to NBA, there's always a curve, a learning curve. And that first year was that learning curve. I think we went about 500. And I tried to pick the brain of the coach I was working for and learn as much as I could. And an experience I remember the most is one of my players' parents kind of gave me the blues after the game one night. And I remember going home like, wow, is this what it's about? But, you know, it just made me say, I got to get on my game better. I got to learn more. And I think that's kind of the thing I try to tell young coaches is never stop learning. And that's part of the reason why I listen to you guys' podcast a lot, because there's so much information out there, whether you're using it now or whether you can put it in your, I call it your goodie bag, and use it later for whatever experience is needed. I think you got to continue to learn at all times.
Yeah, that's a great point about maybe not necessarily pulling something out that you can use right away in the moment. But that's one of the actually things that I've enjoyed talking to coaches about on the podcast is just what's kind of their system for keeping track of things that as they go about being a lifelong learner, like what systems do they use to remember all the things that they hear or see or take in from mentors and other coaches? Because we all know that you can listen to a podcast or you can read a book or you can watch a video or go to a clinic. And if you're not writing that stuff down and actively going back and looking at it, you're not going to end up probably utilizing it unless you have it saved somewhere. So I always find it fascinating, just, you know, coaches that use the three ring binder versus coaches who have it on a file, and some people have it on their phone, or they send an email to themselves, or whatever system that coaches have. I think it's so critically important that coaches do that, because if you don't, a lot of the good information that you might intake ends up going right back out because you just don't retain everything. And so I think from a standpoint of, you talk about as a young coach trying to learn from the coach you were working for in that first year and really trying to intake as much as you possibly could to help yourself become a better coach, I think that's a lesson that every coach can learn. It doesn't matter if you're a young coach or an old coach, you can always learn something from somebody. And that attitude of being a lifelong learner, I think, is so important. If you go back to that time when you were in that first year as a JV coach, what is something that you feel like you took to pretty naturally and you did pretty well that first year? And what's something that when you look back on that first year, you're like, oh man, I was terrible at that?
Probably something that I thought I did well was relating to the players. And I think that's really easy, especially just coming out of college. I think, you know, you probably listen to the same music. You can probably relate to what they're thinking about. So it's easy for them to talk to you. Not even just the stuff about basketball, but stuff that's not going on the court. But the hardest thing is realizing that you don't play anymore. I realized that very quickly, because as a young coach, many times we want to get out there and play with our guys. But if we're playing with our guys, sometimes you don't get to see everything that's going on. Now, you may can see the guy didn't cut, but can you see what's going on a defensive end when they're not rotating? You can't do that. So I had to learn that I can go play in a men's league, but I can't play when I'm in practice with my guys. And the other thing was just the game management. You know, how to sub, when to sub, trusting yourself on certain things. I think that was the greatest thing that I had to improve upon. I think that first year gave me that avenue to improve upon it. You know, I go back to, you know, you're talking about that, how coaches keep notes. And I remember going to clinics. You know, that was the first time I had went to a coaching clinic, was during the spring of that year. And you try to take all these notes down and you think you can use them right away once you get back to your team. In reality, you can't. I think that's the other thing that I learned during that first year, even though it was kind of after the first year, was that you can't use everything right away. Some things need to be stored and held on to just to the perfect time. But that's kind of how that first year went. But I think it benefited me that next year, because the next year we lost one game. Unfortunately, that game was in the playoffs, but we lost one game. So we went undefeated during the regular season. And those JV guys end up being real crucial guys following their 10th grade year on that varsity team for the next 2 years.
So you take the lessons that you learn each year and you try to apply them to your next situation, obviously, so that you can continue to get better, whether that's you're in the same position and you continue on with just the next year's team, because clearly there's a lot of turnover when you're talking about high school basketball. If you're coaching a JV team, guys moving up, guys moving down, you're getting a whole new group of kids in. And so that, to me, I think is one of the most exciting and interesting things about coaching, especially at the high school level, is that your team changes so frequently and you have to, as a coach, adjust to that. When you started your career, and obviously teaching was where you were focused, did you ever have a thought in mind? And I know we'll get to this as we go later, but I think it's probably a relevant question at this point. Did you always think that high school coaching was where you wanted to start, finish, and end? Or did you have in mind that, hey, maybe at some point I'd like to try to coach at the college level? Now, obviously, you did get a chance to do that, which we can get to in a little bit. But just talk a little bit about maybe where your mindset was when you first started.
When I first started, it was trying to be the best I could be at that position. You know, I was blessed to get it. I don't think a lot of people coming straight out of college at the age of 21 they had that kind of position put upon them so early. So I was just trying to be the best JV coach I could be. As I moved along, you know, as I got to be about 24, 25, that's when the thought came in my mind, like, you know, one day I would like that opportunity to coach at the higher level. At that time, I thought possibly the highest level. As I got older, I kind of realized that, you know, college and high school are the two areas that I would really like to focus on. But I think starting off, it was just, let me coach and be the best JV coach I could be. But as I got older, that itch came. And, you know, a lot of people don't get to scratch that itch, and I definitely was able to scratch it, and it was a great time. We'll talk about that later.
Perfect. All right, so tell me a little bit about your next opportunity. When do you get the opportunity to lead your own program, and how does that come to pass?
So after the 4 years at Booker T. Washington High School, which is, you know, a skip, hop, and a jump from Mercedes-Benz Stadium, which was the Georgia Dome, I get an opportunity to go to Dutchtown High School and work for Kurt Miller and be his varsity assistant and be over the JV program. But I also was the varsity assistant and over the JV girls program. So I wore two hats, double duty. And the big thing about this school is a brand new school, opening up with just 9th and 10th graders, but playing a varsity schedule. So you want to talk about really being able to develop some guys, knowing you may get your head beat in some nights with some young kids. But it was, you know, we were two guys about the same age as far as Kurt Miller and I on the boys' side, and the same thing with Nita Gilbert and myself. And we just really kept that thing going, and we were really good about it.
So what did that look like in terms of the amount of time that you were having to put in? You probably had a game during the season. You probably had a game 4 or 5 nights a week, huh?
Friday night, 4 o'clock, 5:30, 7, 8:30. So imagine it's an away game. And at that time, we played teams like Griffin High School. And if you know anything about Georgia, Griffin is where Darren Hancock went. Jay Rome, who ended up playing football, and some other guys that you know that were really good in sports went and played down there. So that's about an hour away. So game finishes at 10. You may not get home until 11, 12 o'clock, you know, once every kid is picked up. So that was some long nights. And it's part of the reason why I tell young coaches a lot of times, you know, you got to grind if this is what you want to do. You got to be willing to put in the work. You got to be willing to put in the time. And it's not always going to be easy. You may not have the time to spend, you know, out to everybody else who's your age. But I did that as well as teaching classes. And then on the flip side of that, I coached football at the time too. So I think it really let me know what it meant to if I wanted to become a head coach, I had to put in the time and grind to show what it's like to be in the office so long and try to get things done. And I think it benefited me in my career.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it did. I think when you were put under those, I don't know, stressful is maybe the wrong word, but when there's a lot of demands being placed on you in terms of the things that you have to do, I think that's when you have a great growth opportunity. And if you can make your way through that and get through that grind and learn from it and take things that are going to benefit you moving forward, then I think you always come out on the other side better for having gone through those experiences. And as I think about what you did there and coaching both the boys and the girls side, I just know that whenever I've coached at the high school level, and there were times when I was the JV coach and time when I was the varsity assistant, and I think that as much as you want your team to, you know, to be successful and to win games, and then you're sitting there as the JV coach and you win your game or you lose your game, and then you're going to the varsity game, and there's still a part of you that's stewing over your game as the JV coach. And so for you, sitting through that quadruple header and being invested in every one of those games, man, that's a lot of, again, I don't know if stress is the right word, but that's a lot of pressure on you every night to go through all those games.
It was, I think that was the first thing I learned. I remember I think I went from the JV boys bench to the varsity girls bench. And Coach Nita Gilbert one time, because I was very quiet and maybe through the whole first quarter. And I remember she sits next to me and she goes, "That JV game is over. And there's nothing you can do about what happened in that JV game. So I need you right now to be in tune with me and how we can win this game."
Yep.
And I think that was really important. And then if I go back a little bit, I've been blessed in my career to have coached football, baseball, track, basketball. But I think one of the biggest things that helped me was my time at Washington. Again, as a young coach coming straight out of college, I was thrust into being a varsity baseball coach and taking over a program that was we went 1-21 my first year. So having to deal with not winning at a young age and the failure and how do you get better. And I remember halfway through that year telling some seniors who were playing baseball because they didn't want to run track because they were football guys, "Listen, guys, I'm trying to build a program so we can get better. So you guys won't play anymore this year. You can still come to the banquet and get a certificate. And I don't hold anything against you, but I'm trying to build a program and we're going to move forward." And we lost with those young guys that year. But I remember my last year at Washington, us going 500 and missing the playoffs by one game in a competitive region with some private schools. And we missed the playoffs because we didn't catch a pop fly in between my outfielder and second baseman. And we were up 12-8. I remember to this day, we were up 12-8. And that pop fly drops and we lose the game 13-12. But that experience as a head varsity baseball coach really helped me understand what it meant to be a head coach before I ever got that first head coaching job after leaving Dutchtown to Cedartown High School, which is near Rome, Georgia.
Do you think that, you know, we talk a lot about multi-sport athletes and how that benefits kids who play multiple sports in whatever maybe their favorite sport is. Do you think the same applies to coaches in that if you're coaching a different sport, maybe than the one that is number one? So for you, basketball is number one, but you coach these other sports. Do you think that you gained a tremendous amount of value from those other experiences? And do you think other coaches would benefit in the same way? Now, obviously, you have to have some degree of knowledge of the sport and all those kinds of things. But all things being equal, if I know enough about baseball or football to be a coach in one of those sports, do you think it benefits a basketball coach to have coached other sports? And if you do, in what way?
I think, and I'm really big on the mental aspect of the game. And I think there are different mental aspects of the game that you do in each sport. You know, baseball is truly a mental game. You know, you fail more times than you win, than you succeed in baseball. How aggressive you have to be in football to really be successful. I think as a young coach, it definitely can help you. I don't think it's something that you should shy away from. Everybody wants to, well, I just coach basketball. Well, I just coach whatever sport. But I think being able to coach those other sports can really help define who you are as a coach. You know, you can learn what you don't like as a coach, and not just from coaching under somebody in basketball. And you can learn about, you know, the attention to detail that football coaches put in. You know, a lot of people don't realize, even at the high school level, that after a Friday night game, they're either meeting Saturday night or Sunday preparing for the next game. One of the things that I learned that I never understood from about basketball coaches at the high school level, they do it in college basketball, but in football, they give their next opponent like 3 game films and say, have what you will. We're just going to run our stuff better than you're going to be able to stop it. And in basketball, we try to hoard our stuff. Like, no, they can't see what we're doing. And we probably got it from somebody else anyway. It's not
true. Yeah, exactly. Well, and nowadays it's so hard to do that. I think that was probably easier to say, hey, we're going to hoard stuff 15 years ago. And we're not going to share our VHS tapes with you and we're going to keep it hidden. Whereas now I think it's, even if you want to hide stuff now, I think it's almost impossible.
Correct. So it definitely does help. I just know that coaching that baseball team, it really helped shape me as a coach and how I had to be a stickler to detail and what I wanted to do. What did we want to be good at? And the fundamentals. You know, for baseball, if you don't have fundamentals, you're not going to win. I don't care who you are. And so that trickles down. I think a lot of times we miss that in other sports. We just think, oh, he's so athletic or he or she can do this. But it still comes back to fundamentals all the time.
Yeah, I agree. You have to have that base. Without the base, it's nice to have the great athleticism. There's no question about that. And clearly, if you can combine the high athleticism with the high skill level, then your ceiling is much higher as well. But I do think that if you just try to get away with just being athletic and not working on the fundamentals, that you end up getting yourself in trouble. And again, I don't care what sport it is. I think that that's true across all sports and across all levels, that the fundamentals win. And then you put that on top of being able to make good decisions in the moment. And that's how you really end up having success. So you learned a bunch of things from all of your experiences leading into that first opportunity to be a head varsity basketball coach. So tell us a little bit about what your mentality was going into that in terms of what were you trying to do philosophy-wise, culture-wise? What do you remember about that time when you thought about putting together a winning basketball program?
One of the big things was I was walking into a situation with a team who they were successful as far as wins and losses. But as a young coach, I think when we get our first job, sometimes we want to change everything. And I didn't do a great job of listening to my guys. I didn't do a great job of realizing what their strengths were. And I just tried to come in and kind of change everything. So probably the biggest thing that I learned was you got to do a introspective research on the team that you're about to take over. But my philosophy during that time was we wanted to get up and down. We definitely wanted to press. But I wanted to out-scheme everybody on the offensive end and show how great a coach I was. And yep. In reality, I remember we got halfway through the year, and I remember my assistant coach had told me this early in the season. He said, Coach, I think we're throwing too much at them. No, they're going to get it. They're going to get it. Had I listened to him early in the season, we wouldn't have had some struggles that we had coming out the gate. And what's funny is I won my first ever game as a head coach versus a ranked team and who was a rival. And I made the mistake of saying the wrong thing in the newspaper that got them riled up the second time. The second time we played them, and they beat us like a drum the second time.
All right, well, I'm not going to let you get away without telling us what the quote was.
You know, sometimes people can take anything to make it, I guess, wallpaper ready.
Understood.
And I said, well, they're a good team, but we're a better team. And they have a great coach who's won a lot of games, but I don't think they had seen anything of what we were ready to do. It was something of that nature. And,
right,
you know, I had never, like, it was so new to me because I was in a small town. Cedartown, Georgia is actually where Nick Chubb played football.
Okay, okay.
So that kind of gives you a little, you know, aspect of what I'm talking about. They have their own radio station that follows teams around. The newspaper, you're the big dog in that town. So you're going to get interviewed after every game. And I was, you know, we had just beat a ranked team at home, and I was living the great life, you know, first ever varsity game as a head coach winning. Got to watch what you say. I guess I needed some media training.
Well, and I'll say this too, that one of the things that I think that the average person doesn't know or understand, if you're just a fan, a sports fan, and you have never been interviewed for a newspaper article in particular, then you have no idea that the things that you say and then what is actually written in print so often do not match up. And I always find it to be very, very interesting when you – I can think of, again, and I never really was interviewed as a coach, but interviewed as a player – often enough that I could see the difference in what I said versus what was actually put down in quotes in the paper the next day. And then also just kind of hearing things about what happened in a particular story. I think about one time we were in our school district, we were on strike. And so, of course, there's newspaper coverage that goes along with that. And I remember things being quoted and said, and my, the guy who was our head coach at the time, he was our union president. And so he was quoted several times. Like, I was standing right next to him when he said things. And then the things that were reported that he said were nowhere near what he said. So I always find that interesting. I don't think people realize necessarily that not every single thing that you, that every quote you read that's attributed to an athlete or a coach is exactly what they said. Let's put it that way.
Would you say it's fake news, Mike?
I wouldn't say it's fake news. I'm not going to go that far, but I do think there is occasionally liberties taken with trying to get what the reporter wants the story to be.
I was just giving you a hard time, Mike.
I know you were.
And I will agree. I'll give you two quick stories. And they aren't at Cedartown, but when I was at St. Francis, I used one. And I know me and the coach are really good friends, but I don't know how the newspaper got this out and how I was able to – I found it. And I put it on our guy's locker when we were going to play them in a championship. And apparently the coach, I say apparently, allegedly, let's go there. But it was in the newspaper. Allegedly the coach said we were just a AAU team. And maybe he was referring to, because our guys all played, most of them played on the same AAU team. But they had grew up together. So, but that was our motivation when we played them. And I know the guy didn't, that's not probably, it was probably said in some other context.
Right.
Me knowing them, but we used that as a motivation. And then the year before, you know, there was a newspaper article that comes out before our championship game, and it doesn't mention our leading scorer, who ends up being Malik Beasley, who plays in the NBA right now for the Timberwolves. And the morning of the championship game, I'm having to deal with, why is the newspaper article not talking about Malik Beasley? And I go, and I'm honestly like, I didn't even get quoted in a newspaper article. So they just did a newspaper article without talking to any of us.
Right. Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, it just goes to show you sometimes too. I think especially when you talk about the high school level and depending on, and I don't know how the coverage is in the newspapers in Georgia, and clearly the newspaper business has changed. But here in Cleveland, you know, our daily newspaper doesn't get home delivery every day. And it used to be that they would have two or three guys who were dedicated to the high school sports beat, and those guys kind of knew what was going on. And it's different now. And so you sometimes have somebody, you know, who's a freelance writer who's writing an article that maybe has no idea about this team or those players or the history of a rivalry or whatever it might be. And they sometimes, again, sometimes they get things wrong. And, you know, hey, sometimes it works in your favor and you can use it as bulletin board material. And I guess in the Malik Beasley case, it worked against you.
It definitely did. I remember going to my assistant going, I'm having to deal with this on championship day. We're trying to win a championship here.
That's another thing, too, that I think fans, parents, not everybody really understands some of those things that don't have really anything to do with basketball. They're just kind of tangentially involved in the process of preparing for a game, that how much time those things take up in a coach's life. And I always go back to, we had a situation, I think it was either my first or second year when I was a varsity assistant, and we were trying to make a decision about whether or not to keep a kid who would have probably been our 12th or 13th player on our roster. And I can still remember the conversation sitting in the coach's office and the three of us kind of going back and forth and, you know, saying, well, you know, this kid, he's a nice kid. He's probably never going to play. His skill level's not quite as high. He's been part of the program. It seems like he's been okay. He played on JV as a junior, got a few minutes. Doesn't seem like he's going to be a problem. Should we keep him around? Should we not? And we batted the idea back and forth and back and forth. And finally, we decided to keep the kid. And it ended up being that I would bet that over the course of that season, we spent more time talking about him, dealing with his parents, and just all these things that took away from, you know, our focus where it should have been on the rest of the team and on trying to win games and develop kids. And instead, we ended up having to put out a bunch of fires with them. And from that point forward, whenever we came down to that kind of a decision, we thought much longer and much harder, even than we did with that one, about, you know, in a lot of cases, we're just better off having a problem quick when we cut the kid and not having to deal with it over the course of the season. Because again, that kid wasn't having any impact on our team as far as what was going on out on the floor because he wasn't playing, but yet we were spending a ton of time with him. And so I think that a lot of times as coaches, we have to end up dealing with those things that don't necessarily impact what goes on in our day-to-day winning and losing and quest to help our team be successful.
I tell any coach that wants to get in this business as a head coach, especially at the high school level, that probably only 20% of what you do involves around the X's and O's part of the game. The other 80% is scheduling buses, dealing with parents, sending off emails that helps alleviate the problems you could have with parents, or just things of that nature that nobody ever thinks about. Eligibility, nobody thinks about those kind of things. They just think about, man, that's great, man. I can't wait to plan practice. I can't wait to the games. That's only 20% of what you have to do. And then, you know, about the situation you told, it's why every year, I don't care from our best player to the last player we keep on the team, even the players we cut, I meet with everybody that night. It may take me a long time as a staff. That's what we do, because I want the guys that got cut to know why we decided to cut them for whatever reason. I want the guys that made the team to know why they made the team and what their role is at that current time. Because I think a lot of times people think, well, I made the team, I got a chance to be the star.
Right.
There are times we choose players on a team that play a specific role that we need. And sometimes that role could just be, I just need you to rebound. I need you to be the greatest practice player because I know you go so hard in practice, but I need you to understand that you may not get a lot of minutes in the game. But it alleviates because you tell that kid from day one that's what their role is going to be. Now, you tell them it also could change as we get along, but that's what their role is going to be. And sometimes you get a kid who is 12, 13, 14, 15 guy that may say, Coach, that's not what I want to do. I'd rather go work. But it pays dividends in the end because now that kid is not causing you problems because he thought he was maybe better than he was or was going to get a different role than the coaching staff thought he was.
Yeah, and I think that communication, it's just like when you think about as a teacher, you want to have communication with parents before you have issues. If the first time a parent hears from you is when there's issues, then that's when parents tend to get upset because you don't establish that relationship with them prior to with a good conversation. I think that's exactly what you're talking about when you meet with somebody on the first day that you're determining who's on the team, who's not on the team. And so when you have the when you have that kind of conversation, let's focus on with the kid who makes the team, but maybe you don't foresee their role as being somebody who's going to get a lot of playing time. Do you get pushback or have you gotten pushback from a kid? And then where does that conversation go when, let's say, you tell the kid, hey, we think you're going to be a really great practice player. We're not sure at this point that there's going to be a lot of minutes for you. Not that there's, not that you can't work your way into that, but let's say the kid had a different idea going into it that they thought, hey, right now I think I'm going to be a starter. I think I'm going to get a lot of minutes. What's that conversation look like if the kid pushes back, for lack of a better way of saying it?
You do get pushed back, but, you know, hopefully in those situations, you built some kind of truth and trust with that kid, and maybe not because it could be a new kid. And so then you just got to tell them why. You know, it could be something as simple as we're bringing everybody back from a team that went to the Sweet 16. and so right now you're just behind the eight ball. They know everything that we want to do, whether it's how we practice, how we play, what play to run at what time, how I like, you know, I know them, how I need to get on each player, and I'm still learning you. If you're willing to adjust and roll with the punches to start off, so to speak, let's see where this thing goes. But sometimes it just has to come down to it. Like, listen, these guys are better than you at this particular point. Can you continue to work and get better? Yes, you can. And if that takes place, then we got to reevaluate. You know, we always get the player an opportunity to better himself by saying that, you know, they get an opportunity to be better. So how do we do that? We have impact stats for our games. And because I think a lot of times kids these days just think you can only impact the game by how many points you score. And so we look at other things, you know, the rebounds, the assists, you know, the deflections, all those kind of things about how you impact the game. And you'll be surprised how that changes the outlook on some guys. And maybe you realize that a guy you thought wasn't going to be really big in your rotation is a guy that doesn't score, but maybe a couple of baskets a game, but he just gets deflections. He defends. Every time he's on the floor, something good happens. And I think it helps us as coaches too. Like, sometimes we only look at the things that we can obviously really see during a game and say, man, that guy needs to be playing. But those impact stats kind of really help us. And then we try to grade practice, even at the high school level. It used to be a time where I tried to grade everybody at practice. But what we try to do now is we do everything competitively. And there's a winner and loser for every drill, whether it's a shooting drill, whether it's a shell drill, whether it's, you know, whatever it is, there's a winner and a loser. And then we just grade every practice totally. Because we just want them to be 1% better every day.
All right, so I want to ask you that. This is a question that I often have when I hear about coaches that are charting and doing those kinds of things. And my experience as – I've never been a high school varsity head coach, but I've spent a lot of time coaching my own kids where typically it's just me or maybe I have one other coach that is with me. So when you're charting and you're keeping track of impact stats and you're going to – have every drill be competitive and mark down who wins and who loses. How do you go about doing that? What is your record keeping system looking like? Who is doing that actual charting for you or as practice is going on? Because I always find when it's me as like one set of eyes, if I try to even like keep track of a score of something, especially if it's anything more than just like who scores a basket, before you know it, I'm totally discombobulated. I have no idea like what the score is because this team got an offensive rebound, which is worth 1 point, and this deflection's worth 2. And so just talk a little bit about how you go about setting that up to benefit you in the way that you want it to.
It's utilizing your coaching staff and utilizing your manager. So the managers are really in charge of, you know, we try to set teams every day. You know, who's in crimson, who's in white. You know, if we have a third team, maybe who's in black. And those would be our teams that day. And our manager's in charge of who wins what drills every day. But usually, like, you know, overall who wins it. But we'll know who won at that particular moment. And then we have a coach. You know, I'm big on assistant coaches being a head coach of their area. And so my job and what I try to do is I don't want yes men or women. So they have a job, a head coaching job, I call it. Whether it's I call somebody a defensive coordinator. You know, I kind of handle, you know, the offensive end, but somebody's watching rebounding in practice. Somebody's watching, you know, defense. Somebody's watching our communication. But even when we get to the games, there's a coach that is over our impact stats. So Huddle does a great job of breaking our film down for us. So that helps. But we also chart during the game. We have one of our coaches with an iPad, and he's able to chart during the game. And so we can kind of get those stats, and our coach has it for us the next day. That's his job. Like, I have a coach that whose job is to upload the film, you know. And I wasn't that way until after I went to college. I'm going to be honest with you. And I realized the impact of something I learned by coaching college is everybody has a job. You know, when I was a doughboy at Georgia Southern, I was over video and I was over travel. But there was somebody else who was over, you know, the budget for the gear. There was somebody else who was over scheduling. Everybody has a job. And that's kind of what I took from that and took back with me to the high school level.
Do you write up formal job descriptions for those things? Or is it something that you just kind of determine with your staff, or you talk it over and say, okay, these are the things that we need to do. I need a defensive coordinator. Who's interested in doing that? Obviously, coaches have strengths and weaknesses. So just how do you go about assigning roles within your coaching staff?
So every year, and then even after the year, I meet with my coaches together and individually. And I want to know what they love to do, what they like to do, I tell them what I think they're good at, and what they want to, you know, try to work on. So I try to piece all that together and place them in the right spots. And that's kind of how we go. But it is written out. And when we have our first meeting, like I think we had ours maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago before we got to workouts. We met as a staff all the way down to our middle school. Like, everybody had their role of what I needed you to do that was going to benefit us as a team. Because it's not just me. I can't do all those roles. So I'm going to need them to, you know, we're doing a leadership series in our program this year. So I needed somebody that was going to be over our leadership series, that every Wednesday during the season, well, we're meeting with our community leaders. We're meeting with alumni, you know, obviously with the things going on with the racial injustice, we're meeting with police officers to help our kids be better. Media training, you know, we were just talking about media training. Like, yep. You know, it may not be so much with talking to a newspaper, but more so with social media. So those things are in writing so they can see it, because you never want somebody else to overstep their bounds, so to speak, unless they need that help or want that help. So everybody knows what everybody's job is, including mine. Like, they know I'm the person, you know, that's got to handle everything that's in the building. They know, you know, I'm willing to drive the bus just like somebody else is willing to drive the bus. And there's some people who I don't have drive the bus because they do some other things for us. So that's kind of how we keep things going. And everybody has that list that I give out with them at that very first meeting.
How do you work with you mentioned your middle school coaches. How do you work with them? What's your philosophy in terms of aligning what they do with what you do at the varsity level? How much are you, I don't know if dictating is the right word, but how much are you guiding them in terms of what your expectations are for what kind of offense and defense they run and how they teach? Just what's your influence on the middle school program look like?
I think we have to have a total program. I don't think you can can deviate. Well, this is the middle school, or this is seventh grade, and this is eighth grade, and then this is JV or ninth grade, and then this is varsity, and everybody's doing something totally different. I think there has to be a flow to your overall program, because if not, you're just building teams. You're not building a program. And I'm into building a program. So our middle school coaches are a part of that. You know, they're at our practice anytime they can. I include them in everything that we do. It's like that beginning of the season meeting. In actuality, my middle school coaches handle a lot of our workouts at the beginning of the year. Because, you know, that way they can have hands-on and get better as coaches. They do some of our scouting for us. So I'm really big on that. As far as the offense and defense, I give them a couple of things that I know that we're going to do throughout our program. Like, they need to run shell drill every day. We're going to be a man-to-man team. Not saying we won't zone, but we're going to be a man-to-man team. That's what we're about. They're going to do our continuity, motion offense. That's something I want them to run down at that level, as well as our space and stuff. But after that, I also want them to be a coach. And I'll tell them, other than that, you can run. If you see a baseline out of bounds, you can run it. But I just need these kids, when they continue to move up in our program, when I call, you know, our continuity motion offense, they know exactly what we're doing. They've seen it before. And I think that's really big if you're building a program.
To me, that's really, really an important thing, where you have an overriding philosophy or just a particular system, terms. I think the terminology is really important, because you could be teaching the same thing at the seventh grade level, and if you call it something different, and then those kids get up to the high school level, even though they may understand the concept, just the fact that it's a different term can throw them off. And to me, that continuity is something that is really, really important. And when everybody's on the same page, we all know, whether that's teaching or coaching, it just makes things so much easier for you as a coaching staff, but also for the players to just understand what the expectations are of them and to feel like they're a part of it. When everybody's talking the same terminology, when a seventh grader hears the same terminology that a senior does, and you kind of feel like you have this special bond amongst the program. And to me, that's something that's really, really important. When you look at the preparation for your season, and obviously you're spending a lot of time in the summer with your kids, whether that's through workouts or playing in leagues or watching them play AAU basketball. When you go into a season, how do you figure out or plan for what you want to emphasize in that particular season? We all know that you can't focus on everything. There's lots and lots and lots of things that maybe you'd like to focus on, but we all have limited time, limited resources. So how do you narrow down what it is that you say, we're going to be good at this? How do you narrow that down?
I think you got to take a look at your program. And what can you be good at? A lot of times, sometimes we try to focus on things that, unfortunately, our teams at that particular point cannot be good at. And what I mean by that, sometimes we want to say, well, I want to focus on, you know, we want to get this many possessions in the game, but we don't have the personnel to get that many possessions. Or I'm not going to say you don't have the personnel. It doesn't benefit you to get that many possessions,
right,
for whatever reason. So I think you've got to do – you've actually got to go back and you've got to dissect your previous season if you're not a new coach, and kind of sit down and evaluate, what do we need to do to get better? What do we need to emphasize this year? And so a lot of times for us, it goes back to, let's look at our overall team impact stats. And what do we need to improve to get better? So, like, one of the big things about my teams is pace. And it doesn't mean how many points we're going to score. But, for instance, our team last year, I don't think we got enough possessions because we didn't push the ball as hard as I thought we could have. Until we got late in the season. So that's something we want to improve upon this year is pace. But I don't think that just comes with pushing the ball. I think that comes with how we practice. And I don't think we got very good with how we practiced until about January last year. And a lot of that comes from being a new coach. They trying to understand what you want. Things were done totally different. So that's one of the things, like, we want to concentrate on. We wanted to concentrate on communication, like going in my first year, communication and ball movement was two big things. So, like, we would chart how many passes we had in the game, because we felt, watching tape of them the previous year, there was a lot of one-on-one basketball, like guys just standing around watching somebody. So we really want to emphasize ball movement, and we want to emphasize communication, especially on the defensive end. And those things worked. When we got, you know, 12 plus assists a game, I don't think we lost with two games. I think when we got, I'm pretty sure we got in January, we only gave up about 45 points a game. And that's the reason why we went to the Elite Eight. So this year we want to concentrate on rebounding. We're not the biggest team, but I thought, you know, we could have did a better job of rebounding. We want to concentrate on shooting. Like, those are two big things that I just think right off the top of my mind. I think we've got to be able to make more shots. When I looked at our effective field goal percentage, I looked at our, you know, three-point field goal percentage, it has to be better. Because we make those shots. There's some games that we lost that we'll definitely win.
Yeah, understood. All right, I want to ask you about two things. You mentioned three things that stood out for you that you've either worked on in the past or you want to continue to get better at. So you mentioned communication, rebounding, and shooting. I want to go back to communication first. When you talk about helping your team to communicate, I think you could probably survey 100 coaches, and all 100 of those coaches would say, I want my team to communicate more. We all have that saying that, look, you can never communicate enough out on the floor. It's impossible to over-communicate. So how do you, as a high school coach, how do you teach kids to communicate? What does that look like in terms of what you're demanding or asking of them, and then what you hope to see them doing out on the floor?
It starts with something as simple as, if a coach sends you a text, then you respond back, and not with a thumbs up. If we send something to group me, you have to like it, so we know that you've seen it and looked at it. And it goes further. Like, when we have practice, you've got to be calling names. We're making passes. You're calling each other's names. And it may sound elementary, but you'll be surprised what that means when somebody hears their name. Every time they know that pass is coming. It means being together in everything that we do. Those little things about communication matter. It means what we do in our leadership program about changing pairs each week with players on the team and getting to know them, having an accountability partner. But you can't have an accountability partner without knowing your teammates. So it's something we did this even with our staff. You know, what are your who's your hero? What's your highlight and what's your hardship? I think the more you know about your teammate will improve that communication. So I think that's some of the things that we do, you know, some small things we do about communication. And me as a head coach, I have to then be able to not just communicate with my players and my staff, I've got to communicate with parents. And so something I do, you know, there's a weekly email that goes out for me. I try to do a great job of planning. They get a practice schedule once the season starts. So even if it's in March, they know what time we're practicing. Now, if I have to change it, that change will go on the email for that week. But then it's every Wednesday, along with our leadership series, we call it a State of the Bear address, like the State of the Union, where my parents can watch practice. Then we can go in our conference room, and if they have questions about the program, I can answer them. I can give them updates on our program. I won't talk about, you know, individual players and say, Johnny had such a great week this week. He averaged 30-something points. That's not what we're doing in the State of the Bear address. It's just talking about our program. You know, maybe why our schedule was so difficult at the beginning of the season last year. When we played all these teams who end up going to, you know, Final Fours and end up being eventual state champions, but how it benefited us on the long run. So things of that nature. I think communication is big, and without communication, I don't think you can be successful.
All right, I want to come back to the leadership thing too, but let's jump ahead to shooting. When you talk about helping your players improve their shooting, what does that look like to you in practice? We all know that for kids to really truly be great shooters, they're going to have to get shots up on their own. But what can you, as a high school coach, within the confines of your practice setting in the preseason and during the season, what do you do to help your kids become better shooters?
All right, so preseason-wise, we want to concentrate on shooting. So what I told my coaching staff is that what are the things that we're going to concentrate on in preseason? We wanted to concentrate on shooting, dribbling, and passing. So every drill that we did had to incorporate that. So as we get closer to the season, we now incorporate some of the things that we may be able to do as a team, but it's still going to incorporate shooting, dribbling, passing. So I think you've got to, if that's going to be an emphasis, then you've got to do it daily, multiple times a day, over and over again. And so even when we get to the season, that means every two or three drills, we're shooting. So I believe we become better shooters through repetition and become better shooters through making shots when we're tired and being competitive in those shots. You'll see that our team will get better. Even though I didn't like our shooting last year, you know, our percentage-wise, we got better as the season went along. I just want us to be better this year. But I think that's because we're able to spend more time on it preseason-wise than we did last year.
Makes sense. All right, tell me about the leadership program. What is it? What did you come up with? How's it structured? And what do you hope to get out of it with your kids?
I'm a true believer that it's more than just basketball. Like, we've got to be able to use basketball to teach our kids about life. We want them to be great fathers, great husbands one day, great citizens of this world, period. So it really was, during this pandemic, you know, I've been blessed to be co-director of the Minority Coaches of Association of Georgia. And we did clinics, you know, every week, you know, where we brought in speakers. And one time we did, you know, we were trying to just help coaches around the state. And we brought in, we called it the high academic coaching clinic, where we brought in Harvard, Dartmouth, teams in the Patriot League, assistant coaches or head coaches to just talk about their programs. And what we heard from Harvard was this leadership program that they do at Harvard, you know, about how they have, you know, dinner with faculty and how they bring in community leaders. And you add what I heard from them to what was going on in the world with the racial injustice. And I said, there's not a more perfect time than for us to implement a leadership series at our with our program than right now. And we were doing some things, you know, where we were bringing some speakers, but it wasn't an every week thing. And so what we decided to do is that every Wednesday throughout our season is that we call it, you know, Leadership Wednesday. And before practice, they're going to get either alumni, they're going to get, you know, like media training, they're going to get a police officer, they may get a teacher, they may get, you know, somebody in the community who's going to come in and speak to them about leadership. Like we have someone that's going to come in and speak to them, you know, dealing with John Wooden's pyramid. You know, I know that's old school, but if you really talk about the tenets of that pyramid, they're still relevant today about how you can be a great team, how you can be a leader. And when you talk about John Wooden, that's what it really was about. We can talk about the championships he won, but think about the young men that he helped mold to become the men who they are today or were back then. So that leadership series is really big with us. And in actuality, one of my assistants, our eighth grade coach has really took that bull by his horn. And every day he said, "Coach, I got this person lined up. I got this person lined up for us this year." And I'm just really excited about it because I know how much it's going to impact our kids. You know, I think they may get much more out of that than they will about how many games we win, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I think those things that happen off the floor can have a huge impact. And as you've said, you're trying to make them be eventually better husbands, better fathers, better citizens. And those are things that don't pay off right there necessarily in the moment. Yeah, there may be some benefit to you season in, season out, where your kids get some value out of it and they're able to transfer that to what goes on the team. But I think ultimately it's 5, 10, 15 years down the road where those kinds of things really pay off. And we've talked about it with lots of coaches just in terms of the fact that we're all in this business to be able to impact kids. And we love to do it through the game of basketball, which is so important to all of us. And clearly the wins and losses are something that drives us, but it's also just the ability to have a positive impact on young people and do it through a game that we all love. And I think like what you're talking about, what I love about what you said was the fact that you're bringing in other outside voices, because we all know whether you're a player or a coach, over the course of a long season, you kind of get tired at times of hearing the same message from the same voice. And even though somebody who comes in from the outside might have the exact same message that Coach Huff has been sharing all season, because it comes from somebody different, it may get through where something that you said, because you've said it so often, maybe isn't getting through in the same way. And I think there's power in being able to hear from different voices. And I think that bringing in those guest speakers and having them be a part of that leadership series, to me, is probably really, really impactful for your kids.
Oh, I think it will be. And we kind of started it during COVID. You know, obviously we were only able to meet with our teams through Zoom.
Right.
But that's kind of what kickstarted this. You know, after hearing what Harvard was doing, it said, man, I don't want to wait till we get back in person, because at that time we didn't know when we were getting back in person.
Right.
So when we met through Zoom, every week, or definitely every 2 weeks, I was trying to have somebody speak to them. So, you know, like I even had a coach who coaches in our same classification, but me and him are really close. We both have made the journey to coach college at a point and came back to high school. He's coached some pros. Like, he was Dwight Howard's high school coach.
Gotcha. Okay.
But to have him speak to them about what it takes to be successful, not just as a basketball player, but in the world. Or to have, you know, Scepter Brownlee, who's an assistant at Mississippi State now. He was at Old Dominion with Nicky McCray, come in and speak, because he used to be a high school coach down here, as well as on the men's side before he went to the women's side. So it made it easier for him as a women's coach. You know, the compliance issues always go down. For him to come speak to my team, because it's not, he can't recruit anybody off my team. But for him to speak about things that, you know, they're looking for, or what he saw when he coached on the men's side. You know, people like that. I even did it with my coaching staff. You know, Tom Crean was very, you know, has been real, you know, influential. And since he's gotten out here to Georgia and helping us do some things here in Georgia, including getting the shot clock.
Yeah, congratulations on that, by the way.
Man, we're happy about that. I can't.
That's nice work.
But he talked to my coaches about things that we can do as coaches to be better coaches, better men. You know, things of that nature. I just think it's just more than basketball.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's no question about that.
If we just rely on basketball, then at some point somebody's going to forget how many championships you may or may not have won, how many wins you got. They're really going to ask you, how many people did you touch? How many young men did you touch? And I think you only can see that when those guys come back to see you. You know, last year was my first year at Holy Innocence, and I have two guys. You know, I was at Duluth for 3 years before then, but I had two of my former players come watch us when they came home for the holidays. Like, I don't think people really understand that. Like, most times people are not going to go to a different school to go watch their former coach. Like, but they did. And one of them's not even playing basketball. Like, he plays football at East Tennessee State, but that's just the impact that I want to make on my guys every day.
Yeah, there's no doubt that I've said it numerous times on the show, but I think one of the most satisfying things that can happen to you as a coach is when you get that phone call 5-10 years later and somebody says, "Hey, coach," there's nothing more powerful. There's nothing that makes you feel better about the impact that you had on a kid when they're still calling you coach when they're a 25 or 30-year-old adult. I said it before, I think, I can't remember which episode we were talking about it, but you know, my high school coach, my college coaches, you know, I'm 50 years old. I still will call them all coach. You know, I'm never gonna feel comfortable calling them by their first name, because you just have that level of respect for what they did for you when you were a young kid. And I think that's what you try to engender as a coach with your players, is to try to get them to feel that influence that you have, and that you can really change someone's life by through what you do with you know, with coaching, and being able to do it through the game of basketball is clearly a blessing for any of us who love the game. I want to talk briefly as we get close to our time limit, but I want to give you a chance to talk about your college experience. So tell us how that those opportunities came to be, because I know you were at Georgia Southern and you were at Alcorn State. So just talk a little bit about your experiences there. One, why you went for that. Two, what it was like. And then three, what made you decide that you wanted to come back to the high school ranks?
So obviously at St. Francis, when I was there, we had a great run, you know, winning a state championship. Three guys who now are part of the NBA. Other guys who went other places, you know, James Banks played for me, who just graduated from Georgia Tech. Josh Coleman, who played at Coastal Carolina. So guys like that who were able to play some at the highest level, even down to guys like, you know, Connor Smith, who played at Oglethorpe. But during those times, we probably had any and everybody walk through that gym to come recruit our guys. And you never know. What I can tell a young coach is you never know when someone's watching. But I always had that inkling, like I said, that itch to go coach college basketball. And so during that time, Coach Mark Byington was the coach at Georgia Southern, and he had came in to watch Josh Coleman, to be exact, and a couple of other kids. And, you know, after our season, I realized he had an opening on his staff, and I reached out to him, you know, was interested in the opening. And he said, "Coach, I already, you know, offered a job to someone. I really like what you do, but I offered a job to someone, and I think he's going to take it. If he doesn't, I'll reach back out to you. But even if he does, you know, if I have something else that comes open, I'll let you know. You'll be the first person to know." Now, to be honest with you, I thought, man, I'll never hear from him again. but I remember it like it was yesterday. It was a Thursday, and I get a call from him, and he says, "Coach, I've got an opening on my staff. It's not exactly what you want, It's a director of basketball operations job, but I would love to have you. Can you come down tomorrow and let's talk about it? And, you know, sometimes you only get certain opportunities. Sometimes it's destiny how God sets things up. And I went down there, and in all honesty, it wasn't even so much of an interview. It was basically him telling me why I should take it, and this is what the job description was. And I remember driving back, and I made the decision then to take it. And that thrust me into that that college level. But I think that was beneficial because a lot of people can be thrust into an assistant college job. But to have that core job of being a director of basketball operations, like where you can't even get on the floor, but you know everything about the ins and outs of what it takes to be successful. Like, we won 22 games that year, and I wasn't able to get on the floor, but I felt like I was important to why we were able to get to the conference championship. And Mark Byington right now plays a very important role in what I do and who I am as a coach, because he always had a saying about find a way. Like, he didn't care what the obstacles were, why you couldn't get it done. He just wanted you to find a way to why you should get it done. He treated us all like, you know, we were equal parts. So all those coaches, including myself, you know, we met about scouts. We met about recruiting. We met about academics on our guys. So he was real influential about, you know, me understanding the college game as well as the staff. We had a great staff. Larry Dixon, who's now at South Florida working for Brian Gregory. Tim Kane, who's now at Murray State. You know, obviously he's had a pro.
Yep.
Working for Murray State under Matt McMahon. And then we also had Andrew Wilson, who's still with Coach Byington, who's now at James Madison. But Coach Byington told me I had to get on the floor. He felt I was too good to just stay in that role. And so when Montez Robinson got the job at Alcorn State, and he reached out to me, and Coach Byington was the person that said, I need to go and take it. And we walked into probably one of the worst situations, unfortunately, when you talk about being on APR. If anybody knows about college basketball, being on APR kind of restricts some things that you can do, whether it's practice time, whether it's who you can recruit. But we just got in there, and I still use that mindset of finding a way, going from a director of ops to still being over travel at Alcorn State, but also being a recruiting coordinator. And we just busted our butts and got players better. And, you know, we went 15-15 that year, which was the first non-losing season they had in, I believe, about 12 years. We kind of turned that thing around, and we recruited some guys that next year that helped Coach Robinson and the staff get to the conference championship and lost by one in overtime to Texas Southern. But I remember when I was there, you know, I think a lot of times we don't understand the sacrifices that have to be made to even pursue your dreams. And sometimes that means taking pay cuts. And each job I took from going from St. Francis to Georgia Southern to Alcorn State, I took a pay cut. And a lot of people would never understand that. And that's probably a story that we could have for another hour and 30 minutes about being in the college business. But while I was there, you know, both my parents died. My mother died right before I got my first head coaching job at Cedartown High School. My dad died shortly after, so she never got to see me coach as a head high school coach. My dad got to see me coach that season only because he died 6 months later just of a broken heart. But one of the things my parents taught me was generational wealth. Like, my mother was the one who kind of, I don't want to say forced my hand, but pushed me to buy a house at 21, which was my second year, you know, teaching. The housing market was great at that time, I will say. You know, so now I had a tenant that was not living in my house at that time, and trying to realize how you were going to make it work was kind of difficult. And I just believe, I prayed to God, and I believe that God sent me to come back to high school for a reason at that particular time. And he sent me to Duluth High School, and, you know, the rest is kind of history about what we were able to do in those 3 years there. You know, most school wins in a three-year span, three straight tournaments in that three-year span with two Sweet 16s, and Adam Flagler's at Baylor, and Devin Evans is at Omaha, Nebraska, and we've got guys at Young Harris and Arkansas Pine Bluff and places like that. We got a guy, like I said, playing football at East Tennessee State. I think things happen for a reason. And God definitely led me to come back to high school. But I was able to take all those things that I learned at Georgia Southern and Alcorn State that really helped me. You know, part of what we do offensively is something I learned from Montez Robinson at Alcorn State. Part of something we do defensively is something that I learned from, you know, Coach Byington at Georgia Southern. In addition to, you know, having a great assistant when I was at St. Francis, Drew Catlett, who worked at West Virginia and Georgia State, and Randolph Macon, whose uncle is Gail Catlett, who used to be the head coach of West Virginia. So having, you know, that succession of things happen, that succession of people have really impacted, you know, who I am and where I am today.
Well, I think that goes right back to the top of our conversation when you talked about just constantly wanting to learn and grow and get better. And at every step of this conversation along the way here, you've talked about something that you've learned that's helped you to grow and have a better understanding of who you are as a person, who you are as a coach, and then being able to pass that along to the kids that you're coaching. And so we're coming up towards an hour and 20 minutes or so here, Cabrel. So I want to ask you one final question, and relating to your job there at Holy Innocence and just looking forward, when you think about what's going to happen in the future, what do you see as being the biggest challenge that you're going to face moving forward? That could be in the short term, that could be in the long term. Just what do you see as the biggest challenge? And then I'm pretty sure I can guess the answer to this question, but the second part of that is, what's your biggest joy in getting out of bed every morning and getting an opportunity to coach high school basketball?
The biggest challenge, probably the biggest challenge is helping players understand why it's important to play for the person next to them. Because I believe we live in a society right now that's so prevalent on me, me, me. So I think every day I wake up, every day I go to the school, every day I get to interact with my players, I have the challenge, which I love the challenge because I think it's an opportunity of helping them understand why you have to be so much better, not for yourself, but for someone that's next to you. I think that's really huge. I think if we can help somebody else and impact somebody else, then we've really done our job. So I think that's the challenge. You know, I think if we can do that, I mean, the adversity that we're going to face on the court, we've got each other's back then, right? So we can face it. So I think that's the challenge that I have. And the joy is honestly when I see my guys succeed in the classroom, when I see the joy, you know, the joy I saw on their faces when we were able to work out again.
yeah,
the joy I saw when we were able to come back to school, to be around each other. The joy that I will eventually see when they get married, and I pray that I'm a person that they invite to the wedding, because I've gotten old enough to be invited to some weddings of former players already. Or even when they have siblings, you know, just during this pandemic, I'll use one example is Kobe Simmons was a guy I coached at St. Francis. So I last coached him in 2014. Now, our relationship has remained the same, his family and myself, no matter what has went on. But to be invited to go to his young sister's graduation drive-through ceremony during COVID just lets you know that's the kind of things that bring you joy. And I always tell people, let's leave a legacy. That you can one day bring your kids and your family back and say, I was a part of something special. That's what we were able to do at St. Francis. That's what we're trying to do at Holy Innocence.
That's great stuff, Cabrel. I just think that when you start talking about that long-term impact, that's really where our value lies as coaches. Before we get out of here, I want to give you a chance to share how people can follow you and your program, give your social media handles. What's the best way for people to reach out to you if they really enjoyed the podcast and just want to say thanks, or they have a question for you and want to talk some basketball? Give us the best way to get in contact with you, find out what you guys are doing, and then I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Definitely. You know, we love any, you know, I love talking hoops. definitely want people to follow our program. We've got some guys, college coaches, that you need to be on if you're not already on them. But you can follow me on Twitter, at Coach Cabrell Huff. And then on Instagram, Cabrell Huff underscore IHIES. I hope I don't offend anybody with things I post, but I'm really a advocate for change as far as our racial climate in the world today. I'm a part of a group called Embrace Us, which is a bunch of college coaches and administrators and people in the NBA who are also about this change, being the change, to help change that. I'm a believer in God, and I believe in my faith, so you'll see a lot about that as well. But you'll also see a lot about our basketball team and our athletic programs at Holy Innocent. So that's how you can follow me. Look forward to hopefully helping anyone that reaches out.
Absolutely. Cabrell's a great follow. If you get a chance to follow him on Instagram or follow him on Twitter, I'd highly recommend that you do that. We cannot thank you enough, Cabrell, for spending an hour and 20 minutes or so with us tonight. It's been an absolute pleasure getting a chance to know you after having kind of watched you from afar. And like I said, the support that you've given our podcast certainly is much appreciated. And what you're trying to do for the game of basketball and the kids you coach, I think that came across loud and clear in everything you said tonight. So again, thanks. We really appreciate it. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks. If you have an existing podcast or are looking to launch your own pod but aren't sure where to start, the team at My Podcast Manager can help. Our podcast team works behind the scenes so you can do what you do best. We'll help you launch your podcast, make it sound great, and free up your time for the more enjoyable parts of podcasting. If you're ready to put your podcast editing, production, and promotion on autopilot with a trusted team of podcasting professionals, visit mypodcastmanager.com to get started.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.